Hi, I'm Adam O'Shea.
And I'm Matt Weller.
And you're listening to In the Box.
Hello there, and welcome to In the Box. Thank you for joining us for another episode. We have a great show lined up for you today, and we're really excited to bring it to you. Adam, tons going on in the sports world right now. But a lot of the news, a lot of what's been dominating the news, I should say, especially in the past week, has been college football recruiting.
Yep. Signing day was upon us last week on Wednesday. A lot of big recruiting classes. You know, the traditional powers, Alabama kills it on signing day per usual. Matt, which classes impressed you the most?
Well, I mean, it's easy to say Alabama, because they once again pull in another fantastic class. Surprise, surprise. Blake Barnett from Corona, California, guy that won the Elite 11. Trent Dilfer was very, very complimentary of his arm and his leadership skills. He's headed to Alabama, a guy that could really thrive in, if Lane Kiffin's still around throughout his Blake Barnett's 3 or 4 years there. I think he's a guy that can thrive in that offense because he is a pocket passer, which Lane Kiffin has had a lot of success with pocket passers in the past. Barnett's got a big arm. I think he's a good fit there. He's not a game manager that you've seen have success at Alabama, i.e. Blake Sims, A.J. McCarron in the past few years. Barnett's a fantastic quarterback that's really going to be a great fit in Alabama's offense. But I think the bigger get for Alabama was Kendall Sheffield and Minkah Fitzpatrick in that secondary. They're losing a lot of guys to the NFL. Those two guys are freshmen that are going to have a chance to start right away for the Crimson Tide and are going to have a big impact on that defense for the next few years to come.
Yeah, definitely going to have to grow up quick and adjust to the game, seeing the fact that Alabama's secondary, like you said, losing a lot of guys to the NFL. But time to see if the boys can play, throw them in there.
And you got a great defensive coach leading the way with Nick Saban.
Oh yeah, of course.
Another big class I was really excited about was Florida State. I mean, it's not hard to recruit to Florida State. I mean, have you seen the women that go to that school? But
beautiful.
Absolutely. But I think this year was the year that they got the heir apparent to Jameis Winston's throne. DeAndre Francois is a fantastic dual threat quarterback. According to Rivals, Adam ranked ahead of Blake Barnett. Now, I don't really see Blake Barnett as more of a dual threat. I see him as more of a pocket passer. But Francois is definitely a guy that can get outside the pocket, pick up first downs with his arm and his legs. He has a huge arm. Not real big. He's only about 6 foot, 6'1", generously. But he has a big arm in the mold of that Russell Wilson smaller quarterback, but can still really push the ball down the field. I think he's a fantastic player. Obviously, getting Josh Sweat, the defensive end, is a huge get for them. And Derwin James is probably the best defensive back in the country. It's a big class for Florida State. Personally, I have them just behind Alabama in the recruiting rankings. But it's still a ton to be excited about for Florida State and Jimbo Fisher.
Definitely. Moving on, I mean, USC killed it on signing day. I mean, Emon Marshall, Ronald Jones III, John Houston Jr. Matt, what do you think of their class overall?
Now, USC did this for the second straight year. They absolutely knocked it out of the park on signing day. And you got to give Steve Sarkisian a ton of credit. I mean, this is the first class USC's had in years that they filled a full class. They got 24 recruits. The sanctions are over, and USC is officially back on the map and killing it in recruiting. They're the only school that pulled in the number one prospect at three different positions. You know Emon Marshall well. You played against him at high school. He's a fantastic cornerback. He's got size. He's got tremendous athleticism, high points the ball. You called it. I mean, I was skeptical that he was going to go to SC. You called it all the way and said he's going to stick in Los Angeles and go to USC. Ronald Jones III is a terrific running back. John Houston Jr. is a fantastic linebacker. I think it's important that USC takes the step this year, because they've had good recruiting classes in the past, but they haven't had depth. So I think it's going to be important for USC to start winning some more games. 9-win seasons aren't going to cut it. But if they can start winning 11 games, 12 games, get berths in the college football playoff, then you're going to start seeing them knock it out of the park even more in recruiting. And that's a dangerous place for USC to be.
I think one thing USC does really well is that they fence off their territory around the greater Los Angeles area, but they are able to go into Texas and into Florida and pick some of the cream of the crop guys from those states and steal them from their backyard. And I think that's really what made the strength of the USC class. I mean, they got probably the best recruits out of California and definitely some of the best out of state. So once again, if they can put it together this year, I mean, I see nothing but classes like that in the future. I mean, they seem to have established quite the pipeline with Long Beach Poly as well as Sarah Gardena. And those are two talent factories in Southern California. And if they keep those up, I mean, going to be hard to beat, especially with recruiting.
Like you said, the thing that separates USC right now is their ability to go and get kids outside of California. I mean, Alabama's going to get the kids in Alabama. USC and UCLA are going to get the kids in Southern California. Florida gets the kids in Florida. But who can go out and steal kids from each other's regions? Ronald Jones III, coming from Texas. He was committed to Oklahoma for a while. USC came in and snatched him out. It's schools like that that can go in and pick kids out from other regions that are going to have the best recruiting classes.
Mm-hmm. You see that with Alabama, who stole Blake Barnett from Southern California.
Exactly. Now, Adam, we talked a lot about some of the great classes. Where did you see a disappointing class? What schools did you look at and say, I expected more?
One school that really disappointed me this year was Oregon. I mean, made it to the national championship, of course, a disappointing loss. But if you look at their class, it's not elite, and it's actually far from it. I mean, they had the number 15 class in ESPN. I mean, their skill positions are all right. I mean, Taj Griffin at running back probably could see the field early, but I mean, it's not an awful recruiting class, but it's not what you've come to expect from Oregon. You've come to expect the Mariotas and the, oh gosh, blanking on his name. Yep, D'Anthony Thomas, blanked on his name.
Now, what I look at it with Oregon, first of all, Alex Ofedile is from Columbia, Missouri, and he did not go to Mizzou. So to put it lightly, I'm salty about that. But if you look at it, Alex Ofedile is not a kid that I'm going to try to build my recruiting class around. He's a good prospect. I think he's kind of a guy that reminds me of DeSean Jackson in that he's not overly big, but he's got great speed. I mean, he's tall, but he's not huge. He's lanky, but he's got fantastic speed. But he and the rest of that Oregon class, it screams good to me. But for Oregon to continue to compete at that level, you need better than good. Now, we've already talked about how we feel about Travis Waller. I think he's a good quarterback. I'm not sure he's an elite quarterback at the college football level. I think the class around him is good, but I don't think it's great. And I think when you're trying to compete with USC, UCLA, schools like that, and you're trying to get to the national championship, you need better than what Oregon got this year.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's going to be a tough year in the Pac-12. I think this
There's
may
be so
the,
many schools this, that can compete in the Pac-12.
Yeah, I mean, even look at UCLA's recruiting class. They got some big names. I mean, it's going to be a tough year.
Cordell Brodus,
Snoop and son, breaking everybody's heart and going to UCLA. I personally thought he was a lock for USC.
As did I.
I mean, you've seen
Daddy is very pro USC.
Oh, I mean, you've
Pete
it's very,
Carroll and
it
him
was,
were buddy buddy.
Yeah, very rarely did you see Snoop Dogg without a USC jersey on. But as he said, he's trading in his USC droves for UCLA. So
absolutely. Another class that I really was disappointed in was Boise State. And it begs the question, has the magic of Boise State gone away? I mean, they won the Fiesta Bowl this year, but I'm not sure that the talent is there for continued success. I mean, they're only the number 68 class overall, according to ESPN. What happened?
Now, here's the problem with recruiting and the system that it is. You know, everybody goes out and ranks these kids on stars. Oh, that guy's a 5-star recruit, 4-star recruit, 3-star recruit. You know, the problem I see with stars is that, yeah, they, when you're looking at stars, you're looking at a lot of measurables. You're looking at 40 times, you're looking at height, weight, different things like that. And of course, on the field ability comes, but you can't fully judge recruits because some recruits come from different parts of the country where football is not as strong. Like, you can argue that a recruit from Connecticut would get less stars as a recruit from Southern California just because of the talent that he plays around, and it's California is a very deep high school football state.
Absolutely.
Now, although their stars and the ranking may not look good, I think Boise State's going to be okay. Because I think the coaching staff at Boise State has a knack for finding great, hardworking guys, don't necessarily look the best on paper, but play well, sacrifice for the team, and honestly, it's gotten them great success. I mean,
absolutely.
Not the most talented players, but I mean, there's something to be said as coming together, playing as a team, and I mean, it's gotten them success.
I don't know how they're going to do without Chris Peterson. I mean, this was his first year not there. They went to the Fiesta Bowl. I don't know. Will that team still be able to develop the talent that they had when he wasn't there, or when he was there? I think the number 68 class, I'm not going to lie, concerns me. I'm not saying it's a be-all, end-all, but I would like to see Boise State move up back higher up in the recruiting rankings that they were pulling when they were more consistently in the polls and winning games. Because they've had a couple down years without elite talent. So I'm looking for the next couple of years as huge years for Boise State to reestablish themselves as a national contender.
Without Gary Peterson, though, was he?
Chris Peterson.
Chris. Happens every now and again.
Now, Boise State wasn't the only class I wasn't a bit disappointed in. I'd say I also was a little disappointed in Northwestern. It was a step back for me. I mean, Pat Fitzgerald pulled in the number 60 recruiting class. It was a down year for them. Really disappointing year for Northwestern football that I thought had been making a lot of strides in the past few years. So I was disappointed in that. Wisconsin at number 38, they dropped a lot of spots after losing Gary Anderson to Oregon State. That's understandable, and it was a big loss for their program, but I was disappointed in seeing them at number 38. I think that's a good football school. Now let's talk about some positive surprises. And you were very impressed with Tennessee.
Yeah. Number 5 recruiting class according to ESPN. They're returning 19 of 22 starters from last year, and Butch Davis did an awesome job recruiting. He signed 5 offensive tackles that were in the ESPN 300. And let's not forget about Khalil McKenzie. I mean, for what you went to De La Salle, ended up transferring to his senior year, but that guy is a difference maker on the field.
He has a rare combination of size and speed that is going to make him miserable to handle for opposing offensive guards and centers in the SEC.
So hard to block. I mean, he's just, like you said, incredible size and speed. I mean,
another guy you had the privilege of watching in high school.
Yes, being on the same field, and my gosh, let's just say it did not end well.
did not end well for our hero, Adam.
No.
Now, all right. Now, I'm going to throw the shameless plug in here and make fun of me all you want.
Here it comes.
But I was very impressed with what Gary Pinkel and staff did at Missouri this year.
Oh,
number 18 class in the country, headlined by the number 2 prospect in the country, Terry Beckner Jr. And I'll tell you what, Terry Beckner Jr. can play. The kid has – you think Khalil McKenzie's got an unbelievable combination of size and speed. Beckner Jr. is right there with him, if not above him. The kid – watching his highlight film, I'm very impressed by that quick first step that you don't often see for an interior lineman. He can rush the passer exceptionally well. I'd like as he develops in the run game, he is going to be a force, and he's, you know, D-line Zoo has been built up over the past few years with you've got Sheldon Richardson, Coney Ealy, Marcus Golden, Shane Ray, Michael Sam, all these guys who have come through Missouri. I think Terry Beckner Jr. is next in line, along with Harold Brantley, who's already here. Those guys are a good future for the Missouri defensive line. I was also really impressed with them getting quarterback Drew Locke, the number 1 prospect in the state of Missouri. Trent Dilfer was very complimentary of him as well, saying Locke is a leader, and he's got the chance to be as good as anybody in college football at the quarterback position. And he said, at the Elite 11, UCLA's Josh Rosen was easily the most talented prospect, but Locke was in that next class with Barnett, Travis Waller, guys like that, Ricky Town from USC. Drew Locke has the potential to be a real good quarterback for Missouri football. So, yes, I'm biased, but I was really impressed with what Missouri was able to do.
Why don't you go ahead and walk out of your study room and cue up the fight song, Matt? Good old Missouri.
Now, right. Adam, I know we were talking a little bit about touched on a couple of quarterbacks that have been in the classes this year. I think we both agree this is a really strong year for high school football quarterbacks.
Very deep. I mean, look around the class. You got Josh Rosen from St. John Bosco going to UCLA. Like you were saying, Trent Dilfer was amazed with his talent. I think he needs a little bit of an attitude check at the next level, but I mean, I think it's gonna pan out for him really well at UCLA. I mean, Blake Barnett going to Alabama. I mean, really the most complete quarterback Alabama has recruited in years. And I mean, I think the class of 2015 was definitely the year of the quarterback, because you look around the class, you need a pocket passer. The teams were able to compete for some of the best pocket passers we've seen in years, and even dual threat quarterbacks were. I mean, it was just incredible depth this year at the quarterback position.
You touched on Blake Barnett. I think he's got the ability to be one of the best in this class. Obviously, Josh Rosen is fantastic. You've played against him multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Ricky Town, Josh Rosen, Blake Barnett, Drew Locke, Travis Waller, DeAndre Francois. I mean, all of these guys have a ton of talent. I mean, we're going to look back in 10 years on this class and say, wow, that was a fantastic group of high school football quarterbacks. Now, moving on to the National Football League, the NFL established a Los Angeles planning panel headlined by some of the most well-known owners in the league: New England's Robert Kraft, Jerry Richardson of Carolina, Clark Hunt of the Kansas City Chiefs, John Mara of the New York Jets, Bob McNair of the Houston Texans, and Art Rooney of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Adam, this committee is going to oversee the potential of moving an NFL franchise to Los Angeles. What are your thoughts on the NFL coming back to the City of Angels?
I mean, I think the obvious question is, what took so long? I mean, this is what the media market in Los Angeles is one of the biggest in the world. The fact that there's not an NFL team in the biggest market in the world for the biggest American sport is ridiculous.
If I told you, let's say, 30 years ago, let's say we're going to go back to the late 1980s, and I told you that in 2015, you were going to have two hockey franchises thriving in the greater Los Angeles area. I know Anaheim's not technically Los Angeles, but you get the idea.
The greater area.
And that there would be no NFL team within a 2-3 hour drive. No one would have believed me. They would have said, "Are you crazy? Hockey?" And I'm not saying that hockey's more popular than football, but the fact that there is not an NFL team in Los Angeles is absolutely ridiculous.
No, it's terrible on the league's part. I mean, think of the revenue that they've missed out on in the last 10, 15 years. I mean, even farther back. I mean, probably a good 20 years here of not establishing a team in the biggest market.
20 years since the Rams moved.
Yeah, 20 years since the Rams have moved. I mean, it's just crazy. I don't understand how they could go so long. And I mean, I think it's apparent to everyone who watches football how much the NFL loves their money. And it's just ridiculous how...
Now, do you think... I don't think that the I don't think Los Angeles is an NFL town. I don't think it's a football town. Los Angeles, to me at least, is a basketball town and a baseball town. But I don't think that can't change. I mean, there's a lot of very passionate football fans in Los Angeles, and even the casual fans, there's enough of them that you could easily support a team. Like, there's no way that the team's going to go to Los Angeles and fail. The Raiders went back to Oakland because they needed to be in Oakland. That's just where they were. St. Louis went back to St. Louis because they were dumb. I mean, that was just stupid.
Yep.
There's got to be a team in L.A. I think a team's going to come. I think it's going to end up being the Rams again. And I think it's going to succeed, and I think it's going to work out well for the league. And the Rams coming to Los Angeles works out perfectly with that NFC West alignment. I mean, it's an easy fit. You don't have to change anything. I mean, if the Jaguars came, you've got to – now they're in the AFC. They're in the AFC South on the West Coast. Now you've got to realign conferences. Moving the Rams to Los Angeles is an easy fit, and I think they've been there before. There's still a lot of Rams fans in Los Angeles. To me, that makes the most sense. I've been to St. Louis multiple times. I live in an area where there should be a lot of Rams fans, and there really aren't. So I think it's a struggling franchise that doesn't have a great facility. The Edward Jones Dome is not – it's not terrible, but it's not something – it's not a fantastic arena. I think while there could be plans to redo it, I think it would be much smarter if they just moved to Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think the Rams – I mean, I think the ownership group would even get to design their own stadium if they came out here. I mean, you've got a lot of options – while you're waiting for that to be built, you've got a lot of stadiums that you could put that in. I mean, there's a blank spot of land that has been sitting in the city of industry praying for a stadium to be built on it. Right off the freeway, just a great area for a stadium to be built. I mean, I think the NFL happen. Yeah, I don't think it's an if it's going to happen. I think it's more of a when. And Absolutely. Hopefully within the next 5 years, but I mean, we are working with the NFL, a lot of people, a lot of money's involved. 75% of the owners have to approve of the deal and the movement.
And it's going to make them money. Coming to Los Angeles is going to make the owners money.
Oh, of course. No doubt.
Now, moving on to teams that actually play in the NFL right now, let's talk about some teams that we think are going to improve next year, one we think is going to decline, and the team a team we think is going to kind of stick where they're at right about now. Now, Adam, what team do you see improving?
Improving, I see the Atlanta Falcons taking a step up from last year. I mean, definitely a down year for the Falcons franchise. I like their head coach hire a lot, and I think Matt Ryan's going to step up, have a much better year, come back to the Matt Ryan that we all kind of learn to watch and know and to love to watch and play, and I think things go a lot better for the Atlanta Falcons next year.
My team that I see improving is the Miami Dolphins, and I say that because Ryan Tannehill took a step forward last year, and Tannehill is a guy. Now, do I think he's worth the $100 million contract they're rumored to be thinking about giving him? No, absolutely not. But he's growing as a quarterback. They've got good young talent around him. I think they could add a few pieces offensively, especially on the offensive line and at wide receiver. I think you could see Miami take a step forward. Do I think they're going to go ahead of New England? No, absolutely not. But that team is exceptionally talented on the defensive side of the ball, and I think they're just good enough where that team could go. I wouldn't be surprised to see them go 10-6 and sneak into the playoffs.
Yeah.
Now, my team on the decline, I don't see the Arizona Cardinals winning 11 games next year because that team, I know this year Carson Palmer was hurt, but to be honest, I don't trust Carson Palmer to come back and stay healthy the whole year anyways, so I'm not sure they're going to have him the whole time. And that's an incredibly tough division. They won 11 games, but I don't see it happening again next year. They got a good but not great defense. They don't have a fantastic running game, and I don't see Carson Palmer to Michael Floyd and Larry Fitzgerald winning 11 games.
Yeah.
That's even if Larry Fitzgerald's back next year, which Larry Fitzgerald stays. I don't know if that'll happen.
Yeah. I mean, definitely a lot of moving parts there. I mean, I'm going to go stay in the division, but I think the Seattle Seahawks are going to have a down year. I think they're going to have, like we touched on last week, in last week's podcast, they're going to have to pay Russell Wilson, and a lot of people are going to have to leave to make that happen. And I do not see the Seahawks letting Russell Wilson go. I don't even want to imagine it. That is how. Oh gosh, it'd be awful. But I think a lot of other people are going to go. I think the Legion of Boom will be broken up. I don't see them having the cap room to keep the successful teams that they've had. I mean, the bargain days with Russell Wilson are over. Time for him to get his contract, and I think Seattle's going to suffer because of it. Not saying that Russell Wilson doesn't deserve the contract, because he does, but they are going to suffer having to pay him so much money and having no room for their other big-name players.
I see Seattle having to give up something. I think you're right. I don't know if I see the Legion of Boom being completely broken up. Byron Maxwell is about as good as gone. But I think they're going to try to keep Chancellor, and they're definitely going to keep Thomas and Sherman. But someone else is going to have to move, whether it's Michael Bennett. Someone else is going to have to go.
I've even heard of Marshawn Lynch.
I mean, he wants a raise, and he's not going to be happy when he's making, let's say, $10 million compared to the over $20 million that Russell Wilson's going to get. Marshawn Lynch is not going to like that.
Yeah.
So
a lot of rumors going around the league about Marshawn Lynch possibly going home to Oakland and playing for the Raiders.
Or retiring. I don't think he's going to do it, but there's been a couple rumors around the league that Marshawn Lynch could hang him up.
I mean, the guy is just so unpredictable that I wouldn't put anything past him, but absolutely it would be a shame. It would be a shame to see him retire with how he has been playing.
Now, what would you rather do, retire or play for the Oakland Raiders?
gosh, man.
That's the fact that you have to think about that. Now, my team that I think is just going to kind of stick is the New Orleans Saints. I see a team in big cap trouble right now. I see a team that consistently does not stay healthy, a team that has a really weak defense, a team that doesn't have the pieces to take the next step. They don't play in a great division, I know that. But I don't see the Saints taking a step to being a 10-6, an 11-5 team that we've seen them be in the past few years. Drew Brees had a real rough year, and I'm not sure he's still among the elite quarterbacks in the NFL. He's still up there, but I don't know if he's one of the elite anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I see that team getting back to 10-6 or 11-5. They went 6-10 last year. I see a 6-10, 7-9, 8-8 type season, somewhere in that range.
Like you said, I think Drew Brees is starting that decline to the tier two quarterback that you'd still love to have on your team, but definitely not at the elite level. My team that I think is going to stick is the San Francisco 49ers. I do not like their head coach hire. I mean, you have Colin Kaepernick, but I've always questioned Kaepernick. I'm not sure that he's had success, but I'm not sure if he's going to have prolonged success. I mean, defense not too shored up. I mean, just a lot of question marks for the San Francisco 49ers. I don't think they'll be bad, but I don't think they're going to take any steps forward. I think they're just going to kind of stay on that treadmill of being spectacularly average for the entire season.
Now, I think San Francisco has the talent to get back to a 10-6 type season. I don't trust Colin Kaepernick the way that other people do. Well, this year was a very tough year for Colin Kaepernick. Frank Gore is getting up there. I don't see the offensive weapons. Vernon Davis is a nice player. Michael Crabtree is a nice player. He doesn't have elite offensive weapons around him. A good O-line, when Patrick Willis and Navarro Bowman are back on that defense after returning from injury, they're a good team. They're a team that can win 10 games. But I don't like that coaching hire either. I think they could have done better. So I definitely see your logic behind the San Francisco 49ers as a stick team. Now, moving on to Major League Baseball. Adam, the MLB is doing a competition right now, heavily backed by fan voting, that is trying to determine who the face of Major League Baseball is. And we were turned on to this idea as Mike Trout of my Los Angeles Angels and Clayton Kershaw of your team that also plays in L.A. were going up against each other. And Trout came out victorious in a slim margin. It was 52-48. Adam, who do you think the face of Major League Baseball is?
Well, although I love Clayton Kershaw and the Los Angeles Dodgers, the team that actually plays in Los Angeles, not the greater Los Angeles area. As a Dodger fan, I'd love to say Clayton Kershaw is the face of the MLB. But I believe that Clayton Kershaw, his personality is too reserved to be the face of the MLB. He doesn't push himself. He never plugs himself into anything. You watch a Clayton Kershaw interview, and it's pretty boring. Just consistent, you know, thank the team. Just been successful, you know, thank my catcher, AJ Ellis. He's not a flashy guy. And I'm not saying Mike Trout is, because I think Mike Trout's humble, but people flock to Mike Trout because he is your typical American hero.
Exceptionally charismatic.
Oh, born and raised in America, plays the game the right way. I mean, I look at Mike Trout, and I see just a kid from Jersey out there having a great time playing baseball. Getting paid a bunch of money to do it, but he's having a great time playing baseball.
Mike Trout has a rare charisma about him. The smile, the love of the game, the way he plays the game so hard. A fantastic player, great, playing in a relatively big market. Mike Trout, to me, I tweeted this last night. Mike Trout, to me, is the face of baseball, and I don't think it's close. Because Trout is young. He's, like I said, charismatic. He's the best player in the game, and that's not debatable. And he's a guy that you haven't heard, at least yet, and hopefully we won't hear anything bad, but we haven't heard anybody say anything negative about Mike Trout. Everyone raves about the kid. And they rave about Clayton Kershaw too, but Kershaw doesn't have the charisma that Trout has. And I think another big part of, as we were talking about while we were planning the show, you brought up a great point. you go to the ballpark and 157 times a year, because the last 3 years he's played 157 games each, Trout will be in the lineup. He's going to play in some capacity. Clayton Kershaw, once every 5 days, I mean, you go and see him probably 30 times a year. And yeah, I think that's something that hurts him because he doesn't play every day. You got to line up when you're going to go see Clayton Kershaw.
Yeah, that's no fault of his own because, I mean, starting pitcher needs his rest, but that is a knock on – I mean, if you're going to be the face, you have to be ever-present. And I don't think a pitcher – or I can't say ever because I think some pitchers are polarizing figures that –
Mariano Rivera.
Yeah, Mariano Rivera, when you're thinking about pitchers that people will drop everything to watch. I mean, there are some polarizing figures who have pitched. But I just think it's so hard when a player doesn't play every night to call him the face of the MLB.
Now, we had a good laugh before the show, but it brought up a serious question. Could you make the argument that Derek Jeter's still the face of Major League Baseball?
I mean, the New York Yankees representative in the league-wide competition that the league put forth was Brett Gardner, but they might as well have just used Derek Jeter again.
I mean, who cares if he's retired?
Let's face it. The guy did everything right for about 20 years.
What I don't understand about Derek Jeter is how do you go through 20 years in New York and have essentially no scandalous stories come out about you?
Loves him.
There's hardly ever been a report that says anything bad about the guy. Maybe some people think he's a little arrogant, but come on. The guy won four championships? Three championships. But he played 20 years in New York City, and there was hardly anything even slightly scandalous about him. That's fantastic.
I mean, Derek Jeter oozes class.
It's a good word. Oozes
just,
it.
Just has an excess of class that if everybody played the game like Jeter, my gosh. And I think what was telling in Derek Jeter's final year at the All-Star Game is there was a picture taken of Mike Trout and Derek Jeter standing next to each other, and it really was the past. I think that picture is symbolic because it's the past looking at the future and saying, this is yours now.
The passing of the guard almost.
The passing of the guard. It was Jeter saying to Trout that you're
the guy.
You're the guy. You've earned it. You're classy. You're charismatic. You play hard. Nothing wrong comes to mind when we think of you. This is your league. This has always been a gentleman's game, and you need to be the gentleman of all gentlemen in this league, just as I was for 20 years. And I think that's why I think it's hard to take Jeter off the pedestal that we put him on. I mean, even if he's not standing on it, that pedestal's still about a skyscraper. My gosh, it's hard to not notice.
Absolutely. Now, well said. Absolutely well said. And I think we can all agree that however this vote turns out, the face of the league's Mike Trout.
Yeah, no, I'm a Dodger fan, and I can accept that. I mean, Mike Trout is easily the most recognizable face in Major League Baseball today, with the exception of Derek Jeter.
And I mean, if you want to look at it one way, he's kind of your coworker. slightly different pay grade.
Slightly different pay grading. I hope to get the raise to Mike Trout money one day, but say a prayer for me.
Now that we've actually agreed on something, let's move on to our favorite part of the show, the National Hockey League segment. Adam, the Western Conference right now is a huge cluster. You've got Calgary, Vancouver, and Winnipeg currently holding on to three of the playoff spots. Do you think they hold on? And if not, Who of that next group of Colorado, Dallas, Minnesota, and Los Angeles replaces them?
This is really tough. I mean, I don't think anybody saw Calgary being in the situation where they are now. I think everybody expected Calgary to be towards the bottom of the league.
Have fallen off by now.
Yeah, especially. I mean, everybody was like, oh, yeah, that's a good story, you know, they made a good push. I mean, even the media in Calgary, I mean, that I heard a story earlier this week about a press conference that the team held in which the head coach explained that, you know, when we make our run into the playoffs and everybody in the media, every media outlet in the room just kind of looked at each other. They said they turned and looked at each other just like, is this guy nuts?
Is this guy for real?
Yeah, is this guy serious? Like, they all questioned it, but I mean, the way the team's played, I mean, it's been incredible to watch. But
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they looked great playing against San Jose last night. They're tied for third place in the Pacific Division.
Yeah.
And now, do I think they're one of the best eight teams in the West? No, I don't. Do I think that Anaheim really, really wants Calgary to get that second wild card spot so they can play them in the first round? Yes, I do. And they're only 5 points up on Minnesota and Los Angeles. But I think they have just enough to sneak in, but I don't think they're going to. I think they're going to fall out, and as much as I hate to say this, I think the Los Angeles Kings are going to get in. Really frustrates me because I would love to see the Los Angeles Kings miss the playoffs, but as of right now, if I had to make a pick, I would pick the Los Angeles Kings to slide into the playoffs over the Calgary Flames. They've won two in a row now after their win last night over the Columbus Blue Jackets. All they need to do is slowly start picking up their game, win some more games on the road, and avoid the shootout. They're 1-7 there this year, and I think Los Angeles gets in.
Here's my problem with LA. I watched, I think, the first and second period of the Los Angeles-Columbus game. I just think they're not deep enough defensively to make a run at this point. I mean, Alec Martinez got hurt, no saying how long he'll be out. I mean,
they're still missing Slava Voynov, and yeah, who knows if he'll come back.
The Voynov situation, I don't see that getting solved anytime soon. I mean,
and
I just...
Right now, after Doughty and Muzzin, it's not good.
No, not at all. I mean, it's Doughty and Muzzin, and then a bunch of guys that have the announcer saying, who?
In the years that LA has had this great, I don't want to say dynasty, but these years that they've had such a good team that Jamie McBain is one of the worst, if not the worst defenseman that's played significant minutes for that team. Now, him and Jeff Schultz are two significantly below average defensemen that are lining up for them every night. You're looking at after Doughty, after Muzzin, you're looking at Robin Regier, Jamie McBain, Jeff Schultz, and now with Martinez out, you're looking at and he was the best of that remaining group. You're looking at a rotating group of defensemen that are not up to par. I mean, that's the lightest way to put it. Mm-hmm. They don't have that depth group of defensemen that they've had in past years that have won them so many games. The strength of the Los Angeles Kings for years now has been
goaltending and defense.
Goaltending and defense. And this year they're not getting that. They're not getting the goaltending. I mean, Jonathan Quick's save percentage since New Year's is under 900 in both January and February. And I don't see Braden McNabb, Matt Green, Jamie McBain, and Robin Regier being enough. Voynov and Martinez, different story. Those guys, I don't think that's enough. I don't think the Kings have enough to win anything. But what I do think is their group of forwards are so good, they possess the puck so well, and I think Calgary is not good enough to hold on to that spot. So yeah. While I go on this rant saying their defense isn't good, the rest of that team, that forward, and I think Quick figures it out, I think they are going to find a way to surpass Calgary into the playoffs.
But Matt, let me ask you this. Do you think the Kings make a move at the deadline to try and bring in a defenseman? And if so, who do you think?
I don't think they can. The Kings right now, they don't have cap space. They have absolutely no cap space, and in large part that's because of Slava Voynov. They've still got his $5 million contract on the books that's just sitting there holding them down. So they don't have the cap space right now to add a piece. Now, getting rid of Mike Richards and sending him down saves them a little under $1 million. That'll help, but I don't think it's enough. I don't think they're going to be able to bring in a significant upgrade defensively that will change the course of that team's season. Now, right now, if I'm the Ducks, the Kings are the team that they would be playing if the Kings sneak in. I'm much more confident this year than I was last year.
Yeah. They don't – it's – the Kings do not scare me like the Kings of last year.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Now, what do you think about Minnesota, Dallas, and Colorado? I mean, those teams are all fighting for a spot. Do you think any of them are good enough to get in? Minnesota's been on a tear, 8-1-1 in their last 10.
I was going to say, Minnesota's really played good hockey lately. I mean, I just have a hard time counting them out because I think they've got a lot of talent on the team.
Absolutely.
Ryan Suter, I mean...
Zach Parise up front with Miko Koivu. Vanek can find his game.
Yeah, I mean, if they all... It seems like they're all starting to click. If they stay on this tear and get into the playoffs, watch out, because they're built to win. They've got offensive firepower. No shortage of offensive firepower if everybody's playing well.
I like that defense with Ryan Suter and Jonas Brodin. I don't know if they're deep enough. They could definitely benefit from adding one more defenseman. I mean, if they want Clayton Stoner back, I mean, give Bob Murray a call. I wouldn't mind that whatsoever. But in all seriousness, Minnesota is finally getting good goaltending. I mean, all season,
that's been the difference.
It was the same story for them. They couldn't get goaltending Backstrom was terrible. They got rid of Josh Harding. Darcy Kemper really, really struggled he got the shot to be the guy, and a .904 save percentage and a .262 goals against just isn't going to get it done.
Yeah, his audition then, was not as he hoped.
Less than inspiring. But then they bring in Devan Dubnyk, who in 10 games since joining the team from Arizona has a .940 save percentage and a .149 goals against average. He was just named the NHL's number one star of the week. Mm-hmm. This is a guy that backed up for the Oilers for years and never inspired confidence in anybody. I mean, he had decent numbers, but never fantastic. Got traded to the Preds. Then the Preds sent him over to Montreal, and nobody wanted this guy. Arizona takes a shot on him in the offseason, plays great for them. They send him to Minnesota. Now he's a starting goalie on a team trying to get into the playoffs. What happened?
I know. It's another one of the leaving Edmonton success stories that you've seen so well with guys like Andrew Cogliano. And, I mean, now add Devan Dubnyk to the list. Add him to that novel of a list that guys that McTavish quit on, Craig McTavish, the Oilers GM, quit on, and have gone on to be successful elsewhere. I mean, Dubnyk's been huge. If he keeps playing like that, I mean, like you said, I think they'll struggle in the playoffs because their defense isn't deep enough. But gotta watch out for them to sneak in at the end of the regular season.
That's a team That's a team that's got three games at hand on Winnipeg. They're 6 points back, but they've won six in a row. If I'm Winnipeg, I'm genuinely scared about Minnesota. And if I'm Los Angeles, Calgary, and Vancouver trying to get that last spot in the other, on the other side, you know, Minnesota with that crossover berth could definitely sneak up there. And if I'm the Ducks at the top of the – who's going to win the Pacific Division, between L.A., Vancouver, and Calgary – I'd probably want to see all of them, maybe not LA, but I definitely want to see Vancouver and Calgary before I see definitely. Minnesota.
A lot of members now, of that team just would scare me to see in the playoffs.
For our final segment of the day, we are going to talk about the James Dolan incident, I guess is the best way to put it. James Dolan is the owner of the Knicks, who say what you want about him. He has had less than a lot of success in the, especially the past decade at the helm of the Knicks. He owns the team, and a fan sent him an email that I will read like bits and pieces of it. The fan writes, "At one stage, I thought you did a wonderful job when you acquired everything from your dad. However, since then, it has been all downhill. You're working with Isaiah Thomas and everything else regarding the Knicks. Bringing on Phil Jackson was a positive beginning, but lowballing Steve Kerr was a disgrace written in all caps to the Knicks. The bottom line is that you merely continued to interfere with the franchise. As a Knicks fan of over in excess of 60 years, I am utterly embarrassed by your dealings with the Knicks. Sell them so their fans can at least look forward to growing them in a positive direction. Obviously, money, and this part is in all caps, is not the only thing. You have done a lot of utterly stupid business things with this franchise. Please, all caps, no more." Now, a 73-year-old man wrote this email to Mr. Dolan. And Adam, Dolan's response was a little less than appropriate,
to say the least. I mean,
Dolan wrote, "You are a sad person. Why would anyone write such a hateful letter? I am guessing, but I'll bet your life is a mess, and you are a hateful mess. What you have done that anyone would consider positive or nice, I am betting nothing. In fact, I'll bet you are a negative force in everyone who comes in contact with you. You most likely have made your family miserable, alcoholic maybe. I just celebrated my 21st anniversary of sobriety. You should try it. Maybe it will help you become a person that folks would like to have around. In the meanwhile, start rooting for the Nets because the Knicks don't want you. Respectfully, James Dolan." Now, first of all, if I'm James Dolan, I'm not putting that I've had 21 years of sobriety, because maybe I can pass off some of my decisions for the New York Knicks on being drunk. But that's maybe not what I would have done. But Dolan, there's really two understandable sides to this story.
I mean,
if you look at it from Dolan's side, this guy sent me an email and just bags on me. What am I supposed to do? Just ignore it? Or you look at it from the fan side and you say he was basically saying it was criticism, but he's basically saying you need to let go, like please stop. And Dolan attacked his personal life that he doesn't know anything about. What's your take on this, Adam?
This is so childish. This is so just beyond awful. I mean, you can call it what you want. Owning an NBA team, you are in the hospitality business. I want you to think about it. Where does your money come from? The people in the seats, the people buying concessions, the people buying jerseys. You are getting most of your money from people who love the team and spend their hard-earned money to go to Knicks games and to buy jerseys. I mean, I just think it's so childish. And how the fact that he had just the testicular fortitude to sign that email respectfully. I mean, this guy has been a devoted fan to your awful basketball team. For what did it say, Matt? Sixty years.
And the Knicks haven't been relevant for 20.
And the thing is, 60 years of just devotion to this team. A season ticket holder. And you're going to treat him like that? You're going to email him, oh, you're an alcoholic? Well, of course he would be an alcoholic. He's been a Knicks fan for 60 years. Who wouldn't be?
Fair point.
Come on.
I see that, but I also see Dolan's point of view where Dolan says, I mean, hey, man, this guy basically just sent me an email and ripped me to pieces. What am I supposed to do? Dolan's a fan. Dolan is, at the end of the day, human. But I think you need to understand, if you're James Dolan, you are held to a higher standard as an NBA owner. You can't – it's one thing if Joe Schmo at the bar sends an email back ripping someone that criticized his work. This guy is held to a higher standard as the owner of the Knicks, owner of the most valuable franchise, maybe the most valuable franchise really in the NBA. And he's got to be held to a higher standard. I'm embarrassed that Adam Silver is not taking any action about it. I think it's embarrassing to the Knicks. I think it's embarrassing to their fans. I think it's embarrassing to James Dolan. So I personally think that it's a joke. I think it's very indicative of the joke the Knicks franchise has been for 10 years. I think it's silly. I think it's, like you said, childish is a good word. I think it's childish. I think it's silly. And I think Dolan embarrassed himself. But
all Dolan showed me in that email is that A, he doesn't care what other people think, and B, his skin has to be made of saran wrap. If you're going to let a guy, I mean, you're a billionaire, and you're going to let somebody email you and get you to the point where you are so angry that you call him an alcoholic, and you don't even know this person.
Dolan tried to pass it off like he was like trying to give this guy advice, like, oh, I'm better than you, and I'm just like, oh, you're a sad man. You could almost feel the anger in Dolan's words. Like, you could almost feel how ticked off he was. But
my thing is, this is telling to me. I was watching First Take this morning, as I usually do, and Stephen A. Smith said, you know, I'm going to be about as open as I ever have been in this show. And he says that he cannot even go up 4th Street in Manhattan because when he passes Madison Square Garden, he gets sick to his stomach thinking about what the Knicks have become. He says that he has his wife make him lasagna on the nights that the Knicks play because that is his favorite dish. And he sits, and he purposely does not turn on the Knicks game intentionally. But he explained it almost like it's a car crash, watching the Knicks when you're flipping through the channels. You stop, and you know what's going to happen. You know that this team is causing you so much pain and so much agony as a New Yorker. But you cannot look away, because you hold out hope. And I think that's what's great about sports, is no matter how bad a team is, no matter how little of faith you have in the ownership, the team they're putting on the floor, there's always that little bit of hope that a miracle will happen.
Unless you're the Edmonton Oilers.
And on that note, where this concludes our episode of In the Box, go ahead and check us out on Twitter. And, I mean, write us an email. We miss you guys. We'd love to hear from you. And thank you so much for listening. For my co-host, Matt Weller, I'm Adam O'Shea. Thank you for listening.